Hi everyone, my name's Dave, I'm an addict. It's really nice to be here. I've got a bit of a cold, but I'll do my best. And I know you put a microphone in front of me, I want to do a Billy Graham about it. You know, it will save your life and jump up and scream and, you know, really sort of march around the room showing off. You know, a lot of stuff goes through your head when you come in to do this sort of chair. You know, what sort of a message is going to be around for a while, you know. God knows where it's going to wind up. Could be anywhere, couldn't it? I'll have to sign a disclaimer around it. What have I been thinking about? I've been thinking about, you know, why I'm here. And, you know, I'm here because this fellowship saved my life. It's as simple as that. And I've come a long way from those days of destruction, desperation, loneliness, despair, all of that that goes with, you know, active addiction. And, you know, like has previously been said, you know, if I think about my qualification, you know, when I came into NA, I was a shuffling vagrant. I'd lost everything that I had on a material level. I'd lost everything that I had, if I had anything, really, on an emotional, spiritual level. And you know, I was completely bankrupt. And and where did that start? You know, I had my first drink when I was about 15 years old. I remember actively drinking like adults. I wanted to be around adults. I didn't want to be around kids of my own age. You know, I wanted to be in the pub with men, knocking it back and giving it large. And and that was the progression for me. And I always sort of maintained that I went through my drugs like a painter would go through their colour periods or their shape periods. You know, I started off in with alcohol, I moved on to amphetamines, cannabis, you know, other class A drugs, just a real progression. And when one drug stopped working, then I'd move on to something else, or I'd have a combination of other drugs to take me to that place. And in the end, I was an injecting drug user, taking all combinations of drugs, injecting till I blacked out, until I sort of overdosed, and people would sort of slap me back into reality and da 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 da, as the tale goes on. And, you know, my using started on a nice social level. You know, pubs, publicans, club owners, taxi cab drivers, they was all my best mates. Oh, where are you going tonight, Dave? Oh, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and so were my peers. People around me were doing the same. But the difference between me and them is, I guess, that they knew when to stop, or they seemed to have an off button, but I didn't have that. You know, I can remember the desperation that I would feel at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning when the pub or the club had shut. And I was left standing, what am I going to do now? Where am I going to go? And, you know, I always remember, and this is a very, you know, very true story for me, is that, you know, on my journey, you know, I was frequently incarcerated. So I'd be in and out of jail. I'd be out there to get money for the high life. And I'd go to jail and have a lay down. And we used to joke about how, you know, dry out and blah, blah, blah. You know, there was nothing, no identification of addiction or alcoholism or anything like that. But, you know, yeah, I'll get fit, you know, get in the gym and get out there and, you know, and live and fight another day. And I remember being in prison once and people, and I guess, you know, and also I sort of shut down around family and that in prison. You tell nobody none of your business or whatever. And people would have pictures of a family and all that on their picture boards, and I had a picture of a bottle of Gordon's gin with the glass, with the ice and the lemon. I'd lie on the bed of a night and I'd go, that's waiting for me, that's, you know. And I never had a serious drink or drug problem at the time, but, you know, that's what I was at. And it would be that continuous sort of pattern, in and out of jails, you know, getting nicked, occupational hazard, come out, party, big time, you know, the clothes, a bit of money in the pocket, just living for the day, never worrying about tomorrow, not taking any responsibility. And I came to a part in my life where you know, I was using lots of drugs, but I wasn't, my drugs were still socially, it was still socially acceptable. You know, it was just cocaine, you know, party, boot, whatever. You know, anybody that took any other drugs, they were scum. You wouldn't look at them, you wouldn't give them the time of day, because these people couldn't be trusted. And I remember sort of getting to a part in my life where I had to take responsibility. My girlfriend at the time became pregnant, and the place that I'd come from, you've got to do the right thing. You must do the right thing. You've got to look after this kid. And I decided to go sort of semi straight, and I got a job, but the job had a nice fiddle, and but I wasn't in charge of the fiddle, so I got quite depressed by that. You know, somebody else was nicking all the money. And it was then that I started getting into the drugs that, you know, started using heroin and da-da-da-da. And, you know, eventually it sort of progressed till I started injecting. And, you know, my partner found a syringe one day. My son was about a year old, and she just went, she'd had enough. And then, you know, and I was rubbing my hands. I thought, this is great. I can use now. I can really use. The flat turned into a shooting gallery. All sorts of atrocious things were happening. And I'd lost, you know, any people that I had any association with, people that I'd had any chance with, you know. I was on the gear, and I wasn't to be trusted, and da-da-da-da, you know, the usual sort of story. But I sort of embraced the underbelly of addiction. I got right in there, you know, all that sort of being like a spy, ringing, so have you got a couple of tapes for me and all that, you know, trying to buy gear and, you know, meet me here and all that. I sort of got right into that. You know, I was sort of like addicted to the sleaze. You do get that. And the whole sort of setup. But I think what happened for me was that, you know, I went off my head. I completely lost the plot. And I remember being in my flat one night, and this is how it sort of all came on top, really, after. And I never got into heroin until I was about 25, but it brought me to my knees in conjunction with cocaine. And I lived in the flats where there was a coke dealer underneath me. The heroin dealer was just around the corner. I was in there one night, and somebody came knocking on the door with loads of drugs, and they wanted to use in my place. But I was obsessed with having drugs for the morning. I had about £2 in change. And I remember driving this bloke, look, just tell him, give me £2 worth for the morning, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I drove him completely out of the flat because he wasn't going to have no nice buzz with me in there, I'll tell you. And then the coke dealer from downstairs came and said, you just broke into my flat, blah, blah, blah. And I lost the plot. And I went out and broke into a chemist and got myself deliberately arrested. Because that was all I knew. I didn't know any other way of getting out of the situation that I was in. But I knew that, you know, in prison, I could sort myself out. I would be all right. That was what was going on in my head. Anyway, when the police came in to take me out of this place, I was taking handfuls of drugs. And the reality was, I never even found any drugs in the chemist. They were my own tablets that I was knocking back, thinking, you know, I'm not going to cluck. I'm not going to cluck. And then my addiction came out. The family found out, you know. I wound up going home for a bit, going to the doctors, and the doctors didn't really understand. They started prescribing DFs. And this went on for a while, and then I went to see a psychiatrist at a DDU, and, you know, and he said to me, look, you know, what I want you to do is write down how you feel before you use, and write down how you feel after you use. And I looked at him, I thought, what do I use? I haven't used for a couple of months. So I went out and used. You know, that excuse. But nobody told me about NA. Nobody, it wasn't an option. And I doubt if I'd have been ready for anything like that, because I was very distrustful. I couldn't reach out or talk to anybody. But I come from a very closed world. And culturally, you didn't tell anybody anything. And I think most of the people that I meet in NA are like that, that we have to break down that wall to reach out. And that's part of your journey. That's part of my journey. But what happened was, with that hospital, eventually I wound up going in for a detox. They took me in. Something must have changed that I didn't see. And I kept going down there. And they took me in. And that was when I was first exposed to this fellowship, and it's very, very clear in my mind what happened. You know, the key worker came up to me one night and said, "Look, Dave, the NA are coming in tonight." I said, "Yeah, I've heard all about them God botherers, Pete, and they're not having me." And he was a really nice man, and he said, "Look, all we ask is that you go once. And if you don't like it, you don't ever have to go again. You just go to one meeting, see how you get on." And I went, and I remember it was a 5-minute walk, and it felt like 5 miles. It was a cold November night, and these two blokes came in, and I sat there, and basically what they did for me was they shared my insides. They shared all the guilt, the shame, everything that I'd done that I felt about my using. You know, I'd robbed my own. You don't do that where I come from. You know, you don't rob off family or friends. But I'd done all that. And they spoke about that stuff. And they spoke about their story. And I sat there, and then they said, "And what we find in our experiences is that what, you know, it's about a commitment to total abstinence. That we don't drink, we don't do cannabis, we don't take over-the-counter tablets with this in or that in. You know, we don't do any of that." And I knew, I mean, I've always found that addicts and alcoholics are very intelligent and resourceful people, and I guess we've had to be. And I heard, and the light bulb went off. You know, I knew that what they were talking about was 100% correct for me. And that was a tall order. It was a really tall order. Because, you know, I had this rationale justification, and I remember having a sort of key working session, and the key worker saying to me, "Let's have a look at your drinking, Dave. How much do you drink on average when you go out?" "I don't know, about 8 pints, and then I move on to the shorts and da da da." He said, "Don't you think that's rather a lot?" I said, "Nah." I said, "Leave off, Pete. I ain't coming here to be a monk." And that stayed in my head, you know. I will have a drink. I will. And I went to NA. They used to bus you out, and I went to NA, and I did really well in that institution. And I could do well in any institution, because I've been in and out of them all my life. Children's homes, prisons. Knew how to get my head down. Knew how to get around. Knew how to get what I needed. Blah blah blah. And a theme came up where, you know, there was a big time dealer in there, and he had gear around him. And I wound up getting a bit off him for nothing, which was a result. I've never had gear, and I'm like, "Oh, you know, lovely." And I used it, and I didn't use it the right way, and blah, blah, blah. And in the morning, went into group, and I wanted a urine sample. I said, "No, I'm leaving this morning, and these are the reasons why. I've got a job, da, 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 da. See you later." Now, the selfishness and the conceitedness of addiction is such a self-centred disease that I left that hospital. And my partner, I still had contact with her. She'd moved into her parents' house, a two-bedroom flat, just off the North Peckham. And I turned up there. I've left the hospital, and I'm staying here. You know, and I've got this guy, and I've got this guy, blah, blah, blah. In I went, and, you know, and I must think about the stress that that caused that family and her at the time. But it didn't matter, because I had a job. I was going to go cleaning windows, I was going to do this. And I still continued to go to NA. I turned up, and I was hoping to be evicted, really. I was hoping that they were going to bar me. And I was sitting in a meeting saying, "Look, I'm not doing any powders, I'm just having a drink, just having a puff, blah, blah, blah. You know, come and sling me out." And they, you know, they didn't do that. They came up to me at the end of the meeting and said, "Look, take it easy. You know, our experience says that maybe one person in 1,000 might be able to drink and use socially again, but I don't think you're that one person." And so, you know, history repeated itself. Before long, I was playing games with, well, I'll only use what they told me in the hospital. That was the other thing that I learned in detox. I learned about prescription drugs, and I learned about methadone and how to get it. As well as learning about recovery. So it was a bit of dark side and the light, you know. And so I started playing that game, then manipulating my girl to get money, to get the private script going, so on and so on. And before you knew it, I was on 120 mils a day, plus using on top, climbing ladders, pulling ropes on cradles, completely out of my box, you know. And And in these flats, I used to get up in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, go window cleaning, you can imagine this, go down into the bin rooms underneath this estate with the black bags and the rats and try and hit up. And I remember going down there one morning, there was some bloke a kip in there, you know, homeless, street, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going, shh, don't worry, it's all right. And carrying on. And I found a garage one down, and some vigilantes set the garage alight. So all this madness that I brought to these honest, hard-working people, just, you know, as my addiction spiralled out of control. In the end, I had to move out of there, and I went back into detox. But I went back in knowing that I was, that it was surrender. And I went back in knowing, within all of that, the seed had been planted, that I was going to go back in and do it the NA way. Okay, there was no negotiation. I knew that alcohol was a drug and that I couldn't drink, because if I drank, I didn't know where I was going to wind up. And I knew that the booze was a taxi cab to my drugs of choice, that my brain had been hotwired in such a way to respond to chemicals, and that if I got anything inside of me, I was off on one. There was no negotiation around that. So I went back in and I did another 3 months detox. But this time, there was a place in Clapham that I wanted to go to. It was 12-step affiliated and... not 12-step affiliated, but like, had that ethos. And but before I could go there, I had to go somewhere else for 3 months. And I did that. So, you know, I needed all of that time to sort of work through all of the damage and all of the shame and all of the guilt, the desperation and the loneliness that I felt that that the disease had brought into my life. And, you know, and that's where I learned about the steps, and I learned about trying to live life on life's terms, and that was a great launch pad for me. You know, eventually I came back to London, as I said, I did some time in that second stage house. And I'd re-established contact with my partner and my son. And whilst I was clean, we had a relationship and, you know, was trying to build on that, really. And some of the miracles that happened to me whilst I was in this program, you know, that flat that I had, I destroyed it. You know, I stripped it completely of all the furniture. I was ripping carpet up to burn it for heat and light. I sold the boiler off the walls. I sold, and then went back the next day and ripped all the copper pipe out and sold that for £3 or £4 for a bit of gear. So when I went to the council to ask them to rehouse me, I felt they had a bit of a conspiracy out against me. You know, why is it you don't want to give me a place, blah, blah, blah. Well, they had every right. But I was on the list, and somebody, a relative of my wife's died, family died, and we got his flat, which was a lovely flat. And that was the start, really, for us getting back together. And it was hard, but that flat was right in the middle of 4 meetings. You know, north, east, south, west, wherever I went, there was a meeting within 10 minutes walk. And even though I was right back amongst it, you know, crack pipes on the stairs every now and again, people, you whatever, it didn't matter, because I had a meeting. And really, you know, I had to put the blinkers on and get my head down and just go to meetings. And I went to meetings every day. I never did 1990, but anything that was out there that was recovery based, I would hang on to it for dear life, because I was very frightened. I was very frightened because there were still a lot of skeletons out there that could jump out and get me. But what I found was, you know, I'd go to meetings in frontline places, and there would be people out there that I'd use with, or people out there that I'd owed money to or ripped off or whatever, and they wouldn't recognise me, because I wasn't the same person that was out there when I was using. It's almost like they walked straight past me. And I think one of the reasons that I came into recovery was that there were certain abuses going on, in terms of I'd lost all my self-esteem, self-respect, and I had some I got myself into some situations where I got hurt by people, and I wasn't even didn't even want to defend myself, and I, you know, something changed in me. The window of opportunity opened up that second time round, And I grabbed it, and I grabbed at this fellowship for everything that it had. And if you said to me, you know, you need to do X, well, I would do it. I looked at what those people had, and when I first came around, it was, you know, it was a little bit, again, you know, I didn't trust. And I'd look at the meetings, and I'd see the pot going around. I'd go, well, who's getting that money here? Where's that money going? And then I'd look at the reading card, I'd see at the bottom, Van Nuys, California. And I think, well, that's where all them sects are, isn't it? It's like all the Moonies and all that. And what about all this God business? But you know, everything that you thrash out in NA, when you ask the question, an experienced NA member will come up and say to you, yeah, well, that's where the fellowship started, and that money's to pay the rent, and there's only a tenner in the pot, mate, so don't drive yourself too mad. You know, and the God stuff, well, it's God as you want to understand it. You know, I came from a very religious background, you know, Irish Catholic family, God driven down my throat every single day. Go to church, and I sort of rebelled against that. So when I came into NA, I was really concerned about that. I didn't like it. And then you sort of understand that the literature and the language is historical. And it's the word God as you want to understand it. So it's not tricky. It's not meant to trick you. This is all unconditional. What works for you? I think about that. Does the group work for you? Does NA want that? That's your God. That's your higher power. And so I started to embrace the concept of a higher power by going to meetings, sitting in a room full of addicts, listening to what they had to say, and getting some power out of it. Got a great deal of power at the end of the meeting, standing up and holding hands and understanding that there's no trickery in NA. You still have to watch your back like you would anywhere else, in a sense, but there's no trickery. There's, you know, people are here, one addict helping another. You know, I was laughing at myself tonight because a good friend of mine came to the meeting with me, and it's like, I'm saying, look, you don't have to drive yourself, man, you don't have to come, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, she hasn't got an agenda. She's here because she wants to be in a meeting. But it's like being able to understand the unconditional relationships that you have with people in NA. We're here to get clean. We're here for recovery. That's what it's about. And then I look around this room and I see people busying themselves with service and, you know, setting stuff up. That works for me. That really feeds me. When I go to a meeting and see NA members buzzing about doing the microphone and the tape and literature, and it's a well-organised meeting, that's such a buzz. That really, you know, that really tells me that the heart of the fellowship is working in that place, in this place. So, you know, the higher power stuff was answered to me, you know, and all that, all the other questions that you might have, that you might think that you could say, I won't do this drug, I'll do that drug. I had no illusion when I came in that I could use any substance again the second time around, because I demonstrated that. I knew that. You know, I rejected the idea that addiction was an illness. Okay, I wasn't having the idea that it was a disease. From what I understood of diseases, they were completely different to the fact that I stuck a needle in my arm, or I was knocking the booze back, or sticking stuff up my ooter. I made that choice. And when it was explained to me, let's have a look at your using, okay? All that stuff that you did that you're so ashamed of when you used, would you do it if you weren't using? Well, no, I wouldn't. I wouldn't have rubbed me mother. I wouldn't have rubbed me best friend. I wouldn't have done X. I wouldn't have nicked her a ring and put it in the bowl. Can you not see then that when you use, something happens to you and that you spiral out of control, blah, 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 blah. Oh yeah, I start to see that. And by accepting the fact that I have an illness that can't be cured but it can be arrested, I was able to free myself up from the shame and the guilt that had sort of dragged me down. Because once I accepted that, and without it being sort of too self-right or an easy way out, because that's what it was. Us addicts, we like to beat ourselves up. And, you know, being good to ourselves is totally alien. And so being in that sort of gentle, nurturing place of actually, you did these things because of your illness, because of your addiction. If you accept that, you can accept the reasons why you did that. And I got some freedom from that. I was able to face those people as part of my journey. And that's the other thing. You know, oh, I'll do the 12 steps and call it a day. Well, I'm afraid it doesn't work like that. You know, you do the 12 steps and then you go back to step one again. In fact, you're always in step one. And you're always in step 10. And you're always doing step 12. You know, so this program has got every avenue covered. You know, it drags people out of isolation and loneliness and desperation. It gives them a place to be. It gives them a sense of purpose. It certainly gave me that. You know, and I was very, You know, I had clear plans when I came into NA that I wanted to be a secretary, that I wanted to be involved, do the tea, that I wanted the top job. And I did all that. You know, if you can call the chair of the ASC being the top job, I had that. I was there for my sins, God forbid. And I've got another top job now. You know, I'm chair of London Convention Committee. Fantastic, what a nightmare. You know, unbelievable. But you know, I've been doing it a few years and I've learned something every year. I learn something about myself. I learn a lot about the fellowship and how it works. And it saves lives. You know, this is a life saver. It saved my life. And countless other people that I come across, everybody in the room in a sense, because it's not necessarily about losing your life and losing the breath that keeps you alive. It's about having any quality of life. You know, I've been around over 20 years now, and you know, that for me is a fantastic achievement. You know, and what I've really spoken about, there are 12 steps in this fellowship, you know, but I'm talking about an extra one. I'm talking about what I would call my step zero. You know, all of that damage. Before I got onto step one, you know, there was step zero. The chaos, the damage, the unmanageability. So when I came round and step one was pointed at me, I didn't understand the language, but I soon understood the concept of, I used to believe that I was extremely powerful when I was using. And what I understood was I was actually powerless. I had no power. In fact, I'd handed all my power over to, you know, a poxy bag of brown powder or this or that. Once I understood that, you know, the other message that I got, when I came around was, you know, don't pick up. No matter how bad it gets, okay, if you get that day or two clean, and life starts to get really, really difficult, the last thing that you should do is pick up. Because you're going to go straight back to step zero. You're going to go back to that mess, the getting and finding ways and means to get more, and running around like a lunatic. And I held on to that. And I held on to, you know, what it is that you get when you come into these rooms, the rituals, the key rings, the claps, the hugs. And you know, an unmanageability, I had no issues about that. You know, I'd rip the boiler off the wall in my flat to sell it. A bill, what's a bill? Who paid a bill? I didn't do that. You know, don't bother sending them. How dare you? How dare you? And so when it came to looking at step two, it was very simple again. You know, that step talks about insanity. When I was using, I was absolutely mad. If I didn't use, there was no insanity in my life. And I know it's a little bit more complicated than that, but you know, that was simple for me. That was basically my understanding of step two, and also understanding that there's something out there that can work for me. You know, learning to ask for help. Step three of this program talks about a God. And handing over, and that again was a great, you know, a great message for me in terms of, you know, not holding on to stuff. I had all sorts of plans when the council weren't going to rehouse me, all sorts of madness. And somebody said to me, "Look, you know, just hand it over, let go, let God do the footwork." Yeah, what do you mean, let go, let go? You know, just do that. And see what happens. And you know, the miracle that came with that. And I've seen that happen to me on my journey so many times. If you just do it as it's laid out, do the footwork, hand it over, have a bit of prayer in your life, things will come together. Step 4 and 5 was about getting rid of all that shame and guilt and letting it go and sharing it with one other person, developing the process of trust. I did that with a sponsor. I've done it with a sponsor a few times. I've had the same sponsor in NA for 18, 19 years now. You know, second person I went up to said yes, and we've been together ever since. So it's not like a sponsor-sponsee. It's like we're the best. We're like brothers, really, you know, when we see each other, get together. Step 6 and 7 showed me those defects that came out of 4 and 5. And the big one for me was false pride. So it was about being able to see beyond that. But the other thing that came out of working that step was that I had some good stuff. Because in my mind's eye, I was no good. I was not worthy. I couldn't look you in the eye. I'd be looking on the ground all the time in shame. I had no self-esteem and stuff, no self-worth. And what came out of that process was that I did have those things. And that I had some value. And NA started pumping its self-esteem back into me. Turning up for a meeting, doing this, putting the chairs out, feeling welcomed, feeling held, that I had a sense of purpose in life. And it was about recovering. The biggest sense of freedom that I achieved through working the 12 steps was working the step 8 and 9. You know, I had a lot of shame and guilt, and I was quite scared of bumping into a few people. Things had gone down that I wasn't very proud of. And I'd done the list, and I went with my sponsor. I said, look, all right, what happens now? You know, what have I got to do? And he said, don't worry, it'll happen. It'll happen when it's meant to happen. And he was right. You know, one day I got a phone call. Blah, blah, so-and-so wants to see you. you know, I had a couple of photographs of when I was using and how bad I got. So I put them in my pocket, and I went off to see him. And I said, look, I'm really sorry about what I've done. And these are the circumstances why. And this is what happened. And it was okay. But from that moment, I was able to really let go of a lot of fear. And I remember coming from that meeting and going to my mum's house because I blamed her for everything. And as part of a process of sort of letting go and accepting the idea that I've got a disease, I went round and said to her, look, I'm really sorry about what I've done. You know, but you need to understand that I don't blame you for anything and that I love you very much. And she died a few years ago. She was 83 and she smoked about 80 fags a day, and it was the smoking that took her in the end. But, you know, I was able to be there and be, you know, responsible, look after her, do whatever I could to support the family and to support her. And, you know, I was at peace. My relationship with her was at peace. And, I spoke about religion at the beginning. And, I recovery taught me to be able to re-embrace or embrace the religion of my parents. That worked for them, like NA worked for me. And like other people have different philosophies and different ideas about recovery. And I embrace it. I'm open-minded because that's what the fellowship gives you. That's what NA gives you. You come from a very closed-minded place. People are either above you or below you. You don't give them the time of day, and that's not where I am now. You know, I accept where people are in their experience and what works for them. That's fine. And that was a turnaround for me. I do step 10s. You know, I take personal inventory, and when I'm wrong, I try to promptly admit it. I'm not perfect around that. You know, there are some situations like my wife or my son. I find it difficult to say that I'm wrong or apologise. But, you know, I'm not perfect. You know, didn't come into this programme to get good. I came into this programme to get well. And I think that's, you know, I try to lead a good, spiritual, straightforward life. I take inventory. I used to take people's inventory quite a lot when I came around, but I was able to get rid of that, because that's a painful place to be, taking everyone else's inventory but your own. And step 11, you know, prayer and meditation was difficult for me. I'm not good at it now, but I do pray. You know, I have a God of my understanding. But the biggest gift for me and being able to do that is around step 12. We keep what we have by giving it away. Those two people came into that hospital that November night and they gave me a message of recovery that saved my life, that turned my life around. It wasn't immediate, but it happened. And, you know, we keep coming in these rooms to give it back. That's what I do. I come in, you ask me to do a bit of service, I turn up, I try and turn up on time, somebody asks me, I assure them that I'll be there. And if I can't do it, I'll ring them up and say, look, sorry, it's not going to happen. So I turn up for what I need to do. You know, recovery has been exceptionally good to me. You know, I liked it so much, I made a career out of it. You know, and I was in a situation the other day, and I've been in the business a long time. I've been in the recovery business for, you know, about 18 years or so, for as long as I've been around, really. And I was lucky to be in a situation where we were hosting an event at a treatment centre that I'm involved in. And, you know, people stood up there and spoke about and what they've been doing in their recoveries and their involvement with fellowships, NA, etc. And I became, you know, so inspired that these people had had an opportunity through something that I'd had a hand in to find recovery in the rooms. And that, you know, that for me, and I hear these messages all the time, but there was something very different about these people standing up and saying, you know, I go to lots of meetings, I do service, my life has turned around, etc., etc. And, you know, and that for me, that just sort of summed it all up. And I think that I need to remember at Christmas, it's a difficult time of year for people that are still in active addiction. But what great comfort we can all take with the knowledge that there are meetings all over the place, there'll be lots of stuff going on, Christmas, you know. So if you are new out there, you know, there's life in these rooms, there's life. There's life without chemicals. And I think that, you know, that's all we need to remember. There is a life without drugs, and NA saves you. I think I'll leave it there. Thank you very much. Yeah.